Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It is the quintessential American idea of resilience, pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps. But that metaphorical action may be harder than it once was, thanks to an economy that remains tough in many areas. It was especially tough for Northern Michigan writer Marty Jo Link in the summer of 2005 when circumstances put her, her family, and her farm on the brink. Fortunately for her, she made it through the situation, and it inspired a memoir called Bootstrapper, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. Marty Link stopped by the Lake Effect studio on a tour through Milwaukee this summer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
The year that this book represents seems like an incredible confluence of events. But yet, did you feel like there was something, was there something universal in your experiences that you imagine people could relate to, if not the them in their sum total?
I think an awful lot did happen to us that year. And if I would have known that all those things were on their way, I might have made some different decisions, but I didn't. And so I just sort of dealt with things as they arrived. But really all of those things, the weather was a big factor, the cold in northern Michigan, feeding ourselves, having some mechanical problems, all of those are pretty common. For rural people, it just doesn't always happen in one 12-month period.
Well, and we should, for people who have not yet read the book, paint a picture of this little farm, homestead, if you will, in northern Michigan where you live.
Right, right. Well, it was 6 acres with a century-old farmhouse. As a matter of fact, on the deed, it says year built, plus or minus 1900. So it's not even recorded what year it was built. So it's old and drafty, but Victorian and beautiful, and a pretty bucolic setting about 8 miles south of Traverse City, Michigan.
When you first moved there, it must have been beautiful and sustainable, more easily sustainable.
It was. The idea was sort of to have a hobby farm, a place where the kids could play, where I could have horses, where we could have a big garden. And it was never intended to sustain a family of four.
And as the book opens, you have at that point just separated from your husband, who takes up residence across the street.
Right. Right. And at the time, that seemed perfectly logical. It seems so silly now, but it was easier for the kids. And we were both pretty devoted parents, despite the fact that our marriage was ending. We both were pretty devoted parents. And so it seemed like it was one of those, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
I imagine there are probably a lot of people, maybe you've heard from some of them, who have read this and said, well, this would have been such a much easier time if she had just downsized when this all happened. Why was it so important for you and your family to stay on this piece of property?
Well, that had been a lifetime dream of mine. I grew up in a suburb, the northern Detroit suburbs, and I just sort of promised myself that when I was a parent, when I was a mom, I was going to raise my children in the way that I wished that I would have been. I wished that I had open land and farm animals and the smell of hay and all of that. And that's what I wanted for my kids. And I think I was not willing to give that up.
Well, and so aside from the separation and the imminent divorce, give people a flavor for just what you were up against, because there are a lot of people who go through tough times like this, but it really, from the get-go, it seemed like the deck was stacked against you.
Right. I was working as a freelance writer, so an editor, certainly nobody is going to, if someone wants to make a big income, that wouldn't be top on their list of careers. So I was doing that. My sons were growing and active. They were 8, 12, and 15, so they had pretty big caloric requirements as well as they were busy. And in the area that I live in, it's a small town. There aren't a lot of job prospects. And this was 2005, so it was just the beginning of the downward spiral that hit Michigan particularly hard. And so I was up against making a mortgage that was predicated on two people's incomes and also feeding us, keeping the house warm, and keeping us mentally stimulated, and just also healing my own broken heart.
You write a lot about how your kids got through that period. It seems from an outsider's perspective that if not for their resilience, this would have been an even harder year.
Oh, I think they are definitely the heroes of the story. They did everything I asked of them and more. And, you know, I gave them this book to read when it was in manuscript form, and I had asked their permission if I could write about them. And they said, well, we don't understand why anybody would be interested in our lives, Mom, but sure, go ahead. And when they read the manuscript, they said, you know, we remember all of these things happening. We remember the freezer breaking. We remember the zucchini contest. We remember that big, long driveway that we shoveled. But we weren't scared. We didn't even know you were worried. We didn't think that we were in distress. And so looking back, I think that might have been my biggest accomplishment that year, is that I protected my children from adult worries.
I was going to say that would seem to be the biggest testament to your resilience in getting through this and the power that you actually still had, even as you might have felt powerless.
I think when other people's lives are in your hands, you have that extra sense of responsibility. I have to do this not just for myself, but for them too. And, you know, there was also a lot of humor that year, and we did have some good moments, a lot of good moments that made up at some point for the desperation that I was feeling.
You mentioned the zucchini contest, mm-hmm. and that was maybe the scene that stuck out most in my mind even well after having read this book. Tell us what led you to become an impromptu zucchini farmer.
Right. Well, I didn't even plant zucchini because, as any gardener knows, you don't really have to. Even if you plant a single plant, you'll be overrun. So I hadn't planted any of that. And then after we didn't have horses on the farm anymore, one day, my youngest son came into the house crying, and I went out to investigate. Well, he and his brother had taken up their battle positions in the pasture, which was now empty of livestock, but had these just horrifically large zucchini plants growing, and the kids were not harvesting them for our dinner. They were heaving them at each other like bombs. And so I immediately halted that. We had a discussion about how important our food was. And just by coincidence, I saw a little poster up at the bakery that said zucchini contest. And first prize was $100 worth of baked goods. So I assigned the boys to each select one of those giant zucchinis and take care of it for the next week or so. And then we entered them into the contest.
And it turned out that you had raised not just a zucchini, but and not even just a prize-winning zucchini, but maybe the ultimate prize-winning zucchini.
They were so huge, and they weren't – I think they must have been some kind of strange hybrid, because zucchinis are dark green with darker green stripes, and these were a real pale green with dark green stripes. So there's a squash called delicata that I think maybe might have intermingled with some strange zucchini. But the bakery didn't mind, and they ended up giving us first and second place. And that really was our bread for the year.
Right, because I think you're right that you had been taking advantage of this bakery already, because they would sell essentially day-old baked goods at a lower price.
Right, yeah, and I was raised by a mother who made all of our bread from scratch, and yet this bakery, it was even less expensive to buy their bread at half price the next day than it was to make it myself. So that's what I did.
At some level, do you feel as though you have written a how-to manual in a way, you know, how to get by when everything seems stacked against you?
I think somewhat. I mean, I think there is some practical lessons in there. And ultimately, I think we didn't necessarily solve all of our financial problems as much as outlast them. You know, I'm pretty stubborn, and we just continued to put our finger in the dike for a year until things got better and until my income increased.
It is a pretty remarkable story of resilience, considering everything that you went through. And we didn't mention everything: broken well, you had vehicular problems.
Right.
You mentioned the horses that started the year with you and finished the year not with you.
Right.
Your efforts to raise chickens. I wonder, now that you are a few years removed from this experience, do you hold any resentment today towards how hard society makes it for people trying to scrape by?
I don't know if it's necessarily resentment. You know, I think there is this myth that people who are poor put themselves in that position and are uneducated, and I think that's false. It could happen to any of us. And that's what was so shocking to me. I mean, I was raised in suburbia by an intact family. I have a college degree and I even have some post-college classes. And yet, you know, I had traveled to Europe and everything else, and yet it happened to me. I think it could happen to anybody. And most people don't realize that. I certainly didn't before it did happen to me.
Was it hard to revisit that time of your life when you sat down to write this?
It was hard. It was particularly difficult to think about the kids and their trajectory that year. And being a former journalist, you know, we're trained not to ever use that word I. In any byline you see in the newspaper, it has the reporter's name, but just the facts, ma'am, sort of. And so getting over that hurdle was difficult. But ultimately, it was incredibly satisfying to make meaning out of what essentially at that time for me seemed meaningless and seemed endless. And to take that and revisit it and see it into the larger context of our lives was pretty satisfying.
How do you think that year shapes who you are today and maybe who your kids are today?
Well, my sons are all doing just fantastically well. My older one is now a sous chef in Chicago. He's 23, and he never went to cooking school. He just did it all by experience and hard work. So, of course, I'm proud of him for that.
Does he use a lot of zucchini?
He probably does. He uses a lot of local. He really knows what's in season and how to prepare it. I'm sure that helped him get the job. And he left home at 19 and really never looked back. My middle son is also working in – he's a full-time college student, but for the summer he's cooking also at a restaurant in Traverse City. And my younger son just got a job dishwashing at the same restaurant. And I was eating there last week for lunch, and the chef came up to me and he said, "Hey, do you have any more?" And I think I raised hardworking kids, and that is going to do them well for the rest of their lives. And for myself, I know the value of hard work, but I think we've lost the connection to physical labor. We're all with our texting and our technology and all of that, which is fine. You know, I have a Facebook page. I text. But there is a place for that. And there's also still a place to be in touch with what physical labor can do for you.
In a strange way, are you glad that you went through that year that you went through?
You know, I kind of am. I kind of am. And it of course, it made a great story. I think, you know, we don't want to read the story. It started out fine and ended up fine. That's just not – as Americans, though, that's not the kind of story we want to read. But it did give me a sense of how important my family is to me. And I'm sure, you know, we all think our family is important. But when we needed to rely on each other, we did. And we know that about each other now. And without that year, we wouldn't have known that maybe quite so deeply.
There does seem like a certain delicious degree of irony in the fact that you can in part earn a living from writing a book about how hard it was to earn a living.
I know. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? You take the thing that was hardest and turn it into something helpful, I suppose. But yeah, believe me, I have thought about that irony many times.
Better to have the irony than not, I suppose.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I hadn't even thought of writing a memoir, really. And I, as a matter of fact, when I was approached to do this, I ended up going to the library and checking out a big stack of memoirs to read and find out what I liked and what I thought worked and what didn't. And what struck me is that at the end of reading all of that, I thought, you know, the parts that stick with me are probably the parts that were hardest for the author to write. And so I tried to keep that in mind when I was writing my own and revealing parts about my own life.
Well, and with that in mind, what was the part that you found hardest to write about this?
Probably the holding back from the boys, you know, trying to continue to make their childhood fun and keeping from them the dangerous and more frightening aspects. I didn't want them to know how close we were really to failure.
There is a really moving scene where you're at a county fair and the length that you went to make sure that they were still able to have fun. We won't give it away necessarily,
right.
But it is a scene that will stay with anybody who reads it for a long time, I think.
Thank you. Well, you know, you hope that when you're put in situations like that, you do the brave thing, but you don't know until you are.
Well, it's a remarkable read, and thanks for sharing at least a snapshot of it with us, Marty Link.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Come back and see us again.
I'd like to.
Marty Link is the author of Bootstrapper, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm, published by Knopf. She lives in northern Lower Michigan and spoke to us earlier this summer. Coming up next, we speak with author Kate Atkinson about her latest novel, Life After Life. Stay tuned. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.